You are listening to Over and Back's Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s. Today's mystery is, what were the biggest trades of the decade? Before we get to the show, I want to tell you guys about Fast Break Breakfast. It's a fellow Harvard Bruxism Network podcast. If you watch League Pass every night but aren't listening to Fast Break Breakfast, you are missing out. It's what happens when you get two musicians and a comic who are overeducated, underemployed, but share an obsession about the NBA, 90s movies, and conspiracy theories. So make sure you subscribe to Fast Break Breakfast, a podcast for serious NBA fans that is incredibly not serious. And now let's begin. Hi, I'm Jason, and with me today is the man behind the NBA Trades Twitter account, blog, and podcast, Raphael. Welcome back to the show, sir.
Thanks for having me today. I'm really good old-fashioned trades. That's my type of topic.
Absolutely. So, you know, the thing that I noticed is, other than Wilt Chamberlain, who's, of course, a special case in and of himself, pretty much all the NBA legends up to 1970 had not been traded. Almost all of them were, you know, stuck with one team. You know, George Mikan, Dolph Schayes, Bill Russell, Paul Arizin, Bob Cousy, Bob Pettit, Jerry West, and Elgin Baylor. I mean, most of those guys, you know, were pretty much associated with one team. But, you know, suddenly 1970 comes along. There's already been a little bit of expansion. The league's at about 14 teams at this point from eight just a few years before. And then a whole new league has been created, the ABA, and just massively increased the size of the player pool. Guys like Rick Barry have already jumped leagues. So it's a different ballgame, and I feel like that was kind of a point in time in which suddenly those guys are starting to, you know, move on to different teams. Suddenly, like, you know, Oscar Robertson, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, Rick Barry, Julius Erving, Earl Monroe, George Gervin, Tiny Archibald, Pete Maravich, guys like that, all through the early 70s are, you know, either they're already legends or they're kind of establishing their legend, but all of them are, you know, fair game for being traded.
Yes, indeed. And I always wonder if it sort of has to do with the growing, like, players taking more ownership. You know, that constant push and pull from ownership versus the players. Unfortunately, that's such a big thing. Well, not unfortunately, but that's such a thing that we see today, that it's that natural growth and eventually leading to where we are today with players and owners and their relationships.
Yeah, and I think this contributes to sort of the messiness of the 70s, in a sense. You know, there's the lack of the dominant team of the decade like there are in the, you know, most of the other decades in the league. There is, you know, like I said, so many teams moving, so many teams being added and subtracted to leagues. There's just so much. It's almost hard to keep track of it unless you really, really study it hard. I mean, the other decades, you know, there are some simple, easy storylines. You know, the 60s, you obviously have the Celtics and the battles with Chamberlain and the Lakers. In the 80s, you have Bird and Magic. The 90s, you have Jordan. But the 70s, there isn't necessarily that one dominant thing that, you know, that you focus on right away. So it makes it kind of harder to dive into just initially.
I agree. It's really tough to sort of, like, get feel for, like, why a lot of these trades were happening. But it's, to me at least, I find it, like, really interesting to, like, see what happened with why these superstars or why this all of a sudden now. I can only imagine at that time, you know, you're used to Bill Russell staying on his team, and you're used to Arizin and Mikan and all these other people from the 50s and the 60s. And so this must have been a shock for people to see your best players moving on.
Yeah, totally. And it's it obviously, you know, there's changes with the money as well. The money is increasing. You know, the finances are going to drive a lot of these trades, as we'll come to see. So just obviously so much revolutionary impact, which makes the decade fascinating to examine, but just hard to, you know, draw clear and simple conclusions in. So the first trade I'd like to talk about is from April 21st, 1970, the end of the 1970 season. Oscar Robertson traded by the Cincinnati Royals to the Milwaukee Bucks for Charlie Polk and Flynn Robinson. There had been kind of bad blood between Robertson and the Royals for a few seasons. The early part of the 60s, the Royals are a, you know, pretty stout team. challenging the Celtics, made some deep runs against them, took them to seven games a couple times, never obviously got over the hump there, and then started to, they had a hard time replacing Jack Twyman, who was, you know, kind of Robertson's top teammate for a while. Jerry Lucas was there, but the chemistry, or you know, whatever it was, didn't quite work. They made some bad decisions, and just overall, there was kind of a Bush League atmosphere for that team. So there had been some bad blood there. And then when Bob Cousy came in as the Royals coach, that situation didn't work out very well either. And Robertson later said that in his autobiography that, you know, Cousy tried to belittle my contributions to basketball. It still bothers me. People say I should forget, but I'm not going to forget ever. All I did was make All NBA 10 straight years. And to hear that I hadn't done enough, it still bothers me a lot. So, you know, Oscar's definitely a guy who, you know, has had a lot of pride and had a lot of, and stood up for what he thought was right. Also was a kind of a demanding guy who asked a lot of teammates and could rub people the wrong way. So, you know, it's kind of hard to know, to kind of assign any blame for what happened there. But obviously, you know, it seemed like it was time for a change. The Bucks are this young and up and coming team with Lew Alcindor, soon to be Kareem Abdul-Jabbar coming up, and Oscar being sent there certainly turns them into a title contender.
It definitely, I mean, like that, and that's sort of like the crazy thing when you think about it. Oscar represents such a big time in Cincinnati, but so when he goes to Milwaukee, like, they take off. And I think that, like what you said, he's known as such a difficult person. And even to this day, you see all the Steph Curry gate from earlier this year when he criticized players or whatever. And sort of that's something that's always stuck with him, this idea that he's an unhappy person or a difficult person. But getting back to like the trade, that's such a, you know, he had such issues with the team, and that's sort of that situation where the Bucks totally just made out with like getting this like big time player and not really having to give up a true like equal talent or equal value for what they got in return from Milwaukee. I mean, from Cincinnati.
Yeah, I mean, Flip Robinson was really the only player. He was in 70. He had averaged 21.8 points and 5.5 assists. So he, you know, wasn't a bad player, but didn't really do much in Cincinnati. And then, you know, kind of was a journeyman for the most part. So it didn't necessarily seem like quite as bad of a trade as it did later. You know, at that point, Robertson was 30 or 31, so obviously getting older. And the track record for guys being effective, you know, to their mid-30s was not extensive in the NBA, you know, by that point. I mean, we were still kind of getting to the point where guys were going to start, you know, in this really this generation of guys, Oscar, Wilt, and Jerry West, you know, being kind of the key guys who would, you know, be effective into their mid and even their late 30s. But, So it sort of made sense to cut bait to a certain extent with Oscar, but obviously didn't really work out for the Royals. They were able to get Tony Archibald in there pretty soon, and he played pretty well, but they were not long for Cincinnati. Ended up moving to Kansas City / Omaha a couple years later and recasting themselves as the Kings. And anything else about this trade that stands out to you?
There's nothing else besides just the fact that, you know, he had such a, obviously Cincinnati's where he put up all of his crazy numbers, crazy individual numbers, but like, it's amazing to sort of to see the, I'm still shocked over looking at the value. I know like what you said about Flynn Robinson, putting up really solid numbers and being a 20 and 5 assist guy. But still, Oscar Robertson is a triple-double man, and so it's really interesting to see, like, just, you know, what impact did this have on, like, future trades in terms of, like, superstars, where teams like, okay, we got to make sure we get as much value down the road, because I think that's the hardest part. I think when we look through all trades that involve, like, superstars, what are you getting of value? Are you going to get players of the future? And I think that's the hardest part, is the especially in 1970s trades. A lot of them don't feature like draft pick being involved in trades. It's sort of just like random players and not really getting as much in return. Whereas nowadays we see, you know, you have to offer 3 first rounders to get a superstar nowadays. So, you know, it's really interesting to see.
There's definitely at that point, draft picks were not valued in the same way that they are today. And considering having an idea of like wanting to keep your draft pick 3 or 4 years down the road, that was just not in anybody's thinking at the time. It was, you know, like throw it in if you need to or whatever. The very few teams were valuing them to the degree that they, of course, are valued today. There's a number of reasons for that.
So we interrupt this great podcast that you're listening to. My name is Kevin Rafuse.
I'm Tim Tompkins.
And I'm Justin Kuzart.
And we host the Drive and Dish NBA podcast.
We cover every team in the league and a bunch of really fun segments like Random NBA Player, Drive and Dougal, and Hot Takes from Reddit.
So when you're done listening to this podcast, give us a search on iTunes or whatever podcast streaming app you're listening on.
We're also at driveanddishpodcast.com. We are the Drive and Dish NBA podcast.
The next trade of interest is Jack Marin to the Houston Rockets for Elvin Hayes, who went to the Baltimore Bullets, who were soon to move to Washington, D.C. This was June 23rd, 1972. And the Rockets had drafted Hayes right after they had become an expansion team in the 68 season. And then they had actually moved the year previously from San Diego to Houston. It was a very hasty move, and the Rockets were not really that well accepted in Houston. There was a feeling that Elvin Hayes being there, who had started at the University of Houston, would have been a big draw for them, and that was not really the case. Hayes, in this trade, it didn't seem as bad at the time as it later seemed. Like, Jack Marin was, like, a pretty good player. Definitely seemed imbalanced, but, you know, Marin was like he was a guy who had been part of some of those good Bullets teams. The idea of, you know, kind of throwing him in there and maybe an improvement in chemistry and that sort of thing, you know, made it seem like okay at the time, but it definitely was one of the more imbalanced trades in NBA history.
Yeah, it definitely was. I mean, I think that's sort of like the whole issue with his personality and whether he, rub people the wrong way. And I guess you know, it's funny because we just talked about that with Oscar. But in terms of like a value, I mean, he put up great numbers throughout his career, and obviously he would go on to even bigger and better things in Washington or Baltimore, playing with the Bullets and partnering up with Wes Unseld.
Yeah, and they would make three finals appearances in 5 years or 6 years from 75 to 79, and win that championship in 78. So, you know, they were very successful pairing for each other. And it wasn't necessarily like an immediate, like you would think that they would fit, because, you know, they're both big guys. They both were playing center at the time. In fact, it's funny. There's actually there's a famous story about that I heard the other day, where Elvin Hayes was complaining that they needed better play from their center, and then Unseld heard that, and he's like, I thought he was the center. So this is funny, given that, because they were both kind of non-traditional players, because Hayes was the bigger guy, but he was more, you know, kind of perimeter-oriented. Unseld was a smaller guy, but he was so bulky and such a, you know, great rebounder. But, they were able to, they did have a lot of success coming off that. I mean, Hayes averaged 21.2 points and 12.7 rebounds over 9 seasons with the Bullets. Actually would end up back with the Rockets after that and finish his career with last few years in Houston. Marin, he'd been an All-Star in 72. He had kind of one more good season and then pretty much, you know, fell off after that. One thing that Hayes was feuding with Tex Winter, who was the Rockets coach of the time, of course, you know, Tex Winter, later famed Lakers assistant, who was one of the forerunners of the triangle offense. And there's a Sports Illustrated article by Peter Carey that says most coaches admitted they would rather take arsenic than Elvin Hayes, and talked about having a fragile ego, and he alternately stormed and salted criticism, was very sullen with his teammates and coaches, and then at a press conference announcing the deal, Gene Shue, who was the Bullets coach, asked if this was strictly one for one. He said no. He replied, "We get Elvin's psychiatrist too." So that's a obviously funny thing to do. But yeah, they worked out very well. They were able to kind of, you know, there's a good post at Bullets Forever that talks about how they had a double post offense dominating on the boards, and they also, the two of them paired with, like, you know, really three really fast guards to kind of play up tempo faster. You wouldn't necessarily think about, you know, given Unselt and Hayes, but, you know, I guess having the guards there able to kind of run up and down the floor, and the big men to, you know, to trail when necessary, but also to be able to stay back, you know, help them. You know, they were a 50-win team, and you know, they had a little bit of up and down, but at that point, you know, they were definitely, you know, for the most part, they were one of the stronger teams of the later 70s.
Oh, yeah, most definitely. And especially all of those, the championship run from that, like, six-year window that you talked about, definitely the trade was worth it. It was very much worth it.
Yeah, and it was a little bit of a risky thing for the for the Bullets at the time, or maybe not risky, but, you know, Marin had been, you know, part of a team that went to the finals in 71. This isn't that far after that. So, you know, they were obviously changing up what had worked for them. But, like I said, we obviously made the right decision there, and kind of a crazy trade in retrospect. So next we go to the ABA. And the ABA, like, most of their trades, I feel like, are at least the most famous ones, are this guy sold this really great player for money because they were about to run out of money. I feel like that's basically the you know, the way that the ABA operate, or they would, like, make weird trades for draft picks. I feel like that the actual, like, good player for good player trades in the ABA, or even, like, you know, elite level player, for the most part, you know, weren't happening. It was mostly kind of cash deal. And the king of that in the ABA was the Virginia Squires owner Earl Foreman, who had notorious for selling off his players when he had money trouble. He'd already sold a Julius Erving to the Nets and a Sven Nader to the Spurs at this point. And then January 30th, 1974, he sold George Gervin to the Spurs for $228,000. Gervin was just kind of emerging at a start at this point. He had briefly played with Erving on the Squires before Erving was traded, but he was coming into his own. He kind of came out of nowhere at Eastern Michigan. He was a guy no one had really even heard of, and had actually been thrown off his team at Eastern Michigan. But somebody from the net, from the Squires, had caught him at a at some sort of, like, Michigan All-Star game, and it offered him a deal and brought him in. And then suddenly they, you know, they had a prize in their hand, but, you know, like I said, they were unable to keep him. The really interesting thing about this trade is that this actually happened before the All-Star game, which was going to be in Virginia. And Foreman didn't want fans to boycott the game. Was already obviously the reputation that they were selling their good players had already, you know, preceded them. So he did. So the agreement was made, and the trade didn't happen until weeks later. So which was illegal, of course, at the time, but it's just kind of like a crazy. That's like one of those ultimate, like, only in the ABA type stories.
Yeah, that's like crazy, and it also shows you just how much, like, financials were, I mean, financials are still involved, but just that the fear of, like, fans leaving affects, you know, like, them trying to make a trade immediately versus, you know, waiting after the All-Star break. That's crazy, though. I had never heard that one before.
Yeah, it's a story in loose balls, so it's a really good, you know, it's a you know, obviously loose balls is an incredible amount of stories, but that's one of the favorite ones. I mean, basically, like, they made this deal, like, in a bar, and then they called to get the, you know, they called the bank to get the money, and then, like, he brought, like, 15 minutes later. It was he, like, the Angelo Drosos, the owner of the Spurs, had, like, you know, recounted the story later of, like, trying to, like, you know, make this deal before, you know, he had a chance to take it back. And so then Gervin plays really well in those few weeks and was great. So Foreman, after the All-Star game, was like, I don't want to do this. And he tries to back out of the deal. And in fact, he was supported by the ABA commissioner at the time. And he said, you know, like, he said, no, I wouldn't approve the trade. He'd already essentially frozen the Virginia roster because he didn't want any more of these types of trades. And then Drosos is like, you know, hey, you know, he threatened a lawsuit. And then he has this letter that reads, blank you, a stronger letter will follow. So, and then, and basically the ABA didn't do anything about it. And then, you know, Gervin ends up with the Spurs and then ends up being the Spurs franchise player and, you know, helps them to later ABA and of course, NBA success. So so that obviously worked out very well for the one team. And Virginia folded a month before the ABA NBA merger and then was, you know, was out of the, you know, the cash settlement or being merged into the league. So it did not work out so well for them.
Yeah, most definitely.
So the next one is actually two trades, but I think they're related enough that they are interesting.
One of my favorite parts of our Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s series is our awesome logo. It does a perfect job encapsulating exactly the tone and feel we wanted with the series. Well, today I have some exciting news for you. The illustrator of that fantastic logo, Daniel J. Rowell, has made the logo, the Cream and Dr. J head, as well as a bunch of other of his art available to purchase at danieljrowell.com. Simply go to danieljrowell.com, that's DanieljRowell.com, click on merch, and you can buy sweaters, coffee mugs, shirts, and more featuring Daniel's art. Now, just in case you're still on the fence, do know that Daniel can hold a piece of toast in his mouth for a solid 45 seconds or so without dropping it. Plus, if you need a little bit more convincing, his aunt has described these shirts as fabulous. Again, to buy your tea, mug, or anything else that your little heart desires, go to Daniel J. Rowell, that's DanieljRowell.com, and click on merch.
The first is October 24th, 1975. Spencer Haywood traded by the Sonics to the Knicks for Gene Short, a 1979 first-round draft pick, and I believe the amount was reported as $1.5 million. Haywood had been a four-time All-Star in Seattle, but then he had feuded with his coach Bill Russell, which we talked about a little bit in our one of our WrestleMania episodes. And despite leading the team to its first playoff appearance in history. And then a year later, December 9th, 1976, Bob McAdoo, the former MVP just a year and a half earlier, was traded by the Buffalo Braves with Tom McMillan to the Knicks for John Gianelli and cash. I believe it was like $3 million or $2.5 million. I'm forgetting the exact figure, but it was a lot of money anyway. And the cash was John Gianelli was all right, but it was definitely a... you know, most of a crash transaction. And this is, both these trades kind of combined are considered a watershed, you know, time for the Knicks. They're, you know, they're most of the players that were on those classic Knicks teams, which you and I are going to talk about in a future show, had been cycled out by this point. Frazier was soon to be gone. Bradley was just about to retire. DeBuscher and Reed had already retired. So they were trying to obviously replace those guys. And this is kind of considered a, you know, instead of getting this, you're trying to find like this cohesive chemistry that you had in these guys and finding these pieces that fit together, it was more of a get these big names and try to make it work. And Haywood and McAdoo were both, you know, power, kind of perimeter oriented power forwards. And the mix for that reason and for the, you know, that reason and for other reasons did not work out so well.
And it sort of ran like so counter to what the Knicks had been built on during those two championship runs. Is just that was like a team of like guys who fit together perfectly from, you know, like all the players, well, Clyde Frazier, Dave DeBuscher, Bill Bradley, and Willis Reed. But like, you know, like what you said, these two big time scorers who play a certain style of basketball just didn't fit with the people who had stayed from that previous regime, like Walt Clyde. So it's just it's really it definitely shows you that how important chemistry is, even like outside of just like talent. From, you know, because Spencer Haywood and McAdoo are two of the best scorers that you could imagine in NBA history, league history. So it didn't work out. And obviously, like you said, that there were some issues and there was some, you know, stuff that happened in terms of like Red Holzman's relationship with them. But yeah, it's just they're great scorers, but it clearly for them, it didn't work out in New York. That's the toughest part.
Yeah.
And as a Knicks fan growing, I mean, obviously I wasn't around for that time, but that had to be hard to go from two championships to, you know, with the heightened expectations with bigger stars and not performing up to that level from previous years.
And you can definitely draw a line between, you know, these two acquisitions and the larger Knicks philosophy for the past now almost 40 years of, of acquiring these big names, but not really necessarily working out either for chemistry reasons or for, you know, these guys are fears past their prime type reasons. But, you know, you look at this era, you look at, you know, some of the, obviously the Isaiah era in the late 2000s, and now, you know, what they've kind of done with Phil Jackson coming into this year, with looking, you know, Derrick Rose and Joakim Noah, and wondering if that's, you know, if they're repeating that same mistake. Maybe it'll work out this time, who knows, but it's interesting how much of that we've seen in Knicks history.
Yeah, it's a pattern that keeps on going, and I mean, it's sort of like anything with history, you know, you're always like doomed to repeat it if you don't like want to actually pay attention. I guess the Knicks have never chosen to pay attention to what they've done in the past. And you're right, like, even up to this point with Carmelo and Amari, like, that whole thing, that they've always committed to going after high-priced free agents. Every free agency they were trying to speak to Kevin Durant, and look at what happened. So it's just, they're always trying to go after the biggest free agents and using the pull of New York City to attract people. But, you know, that is hard because you're not really building chemistry. You're always like leaving your cupboard empty so that you can go after superstars in free agency. But then that always puts you in really difficult positions because you're trading usually young assets or like draft picks. So,
yeah, absolutely. And Haywood, there was definitely, according to Red Holzman, a lot of pressure for him to replace DeBuscher. And, you know, they were completely different style players. DeBuscher was, you know, this rugged, defensive-minded guy what was like seven straight all-defensive first-team players. And, you know, and Haywood was, you know, he was a productive scorer, but he didn't have that same, you know, size and ruggedness that DeBuscher had. And then McAdoo came in. He had, of course, been an MVP in 75 and won three straight scoring titles. Actually would be a top five scorer through the 79 season, despite bouncing from, he'd spent a couple years with the Knicks and then go to Boston and then go to the Pistons. And then would kind of fall off after 79 before resurrecting things with the Lakers. But I always kind of thought about McAdoo's fall as being pretty sudden, but actually he was productive. He just weirdly bounced around a lot. And this is an interesting thing I think about some of these late 70s trades. A common theme in a lot of them is that there are these, you know, guys who are sort of, you know, primed to be the next superstars. Haywood and McAdoo, Pete Maravich, I think, fits that as well. And you know, a lot of them, there's, you know, kind of they get traded like once or twice and they end up bouncing around. Nate Archibald as well. Some of it's injury related. Some of it is, you know, likely drug related as well in Haywood's case. And, you know, and some of it's just kind of weird reasons. But the fact that there are so many of those instances of, and I guess it's sort of a function also of there being so many more teams now, new guys, maybe less experienced guys who are in the decision making chairs, less patient owners. You have, like, you're just adding a whole new population to this ecosystem that had been very conservative just a decade ago. And so I guess it leads to situations that are kind of like that.
I agree. Probably it has to be a lot of different factors that affected both of their situations with the Knicks and just like the Knicks' general situation at that time. And I think the interesting thing is just that they had, like, to get two guys of that magnitude in terms of, like, what they had done in their previous stops, those are really big trades. But, you know, the end result obviously leads to the lack of success that is, to make those, and when you think about it, they didn't really give up a lot looking back at those trades. First rounder for Spencer Haywood and Gene Short, but, like, you know, they didn't really give up, you know, guys who were you know, primetime players. So it's like, it's really interesting to see, like, how, especially, like, sometimes those trades are the ones that could be even the most, even when you don't give up a lot. The trades where you're just sort of acquiring a big name player, and then it just, because of chemistry issues or injuries or whatever different factors like we talked about, that it can really affect you being able to win, even if you're not really giving up, like, a lot of different talent.
So McAdoo feuded with Buffalo's owner Paul Snyder over some issues, and basically they broke up a pretty successful team, you know, coached by Jack Ramsey. You know, they had Ernie DiGregorio, they had Randy Smith. You know, they were a pretty good, you know, they taken the Celtics to, you know, giving them a little bit of a rough time in the playoffs, and looked like an up and coming team. Basically, that's, this signaled the end of that, you know, McAdoo being sent there. And then this was another instance of, you know, Buffalo being a smaller market, maybe needing the cash, maybe just being cheap. They'd soon make, you know, a huge change. But that was basically the, you know, really the end of the Braves being, you know, a relevant team, and leading them to move to San Diego in a, you know, a few years after that. Yeah, 77, McAdoo and Haywood didn't really have much time together. Haywood was injured for most of the season. 78, Red Holzman actually stepped down for a while. Willis Reed replaced him in a sort of a weird move, forcing Holzman out despite his, you know, obviously his great chance as a coach, but figuring maybe Willis Reed would relate to the players better, but that did not work out very well at all. McAdoo was really strong. He had really strong numbers that year. It was third in scoring, and Haywood played health, you know, he played more, but he, you know, he was down from, he'd been a 2010 player for his first seven seasons, but this year he was only 13.7 and 6.6 rebounds, and only played 26 minutes per game. Lonnie Shelton kind of, you know, grew into a bigger role that season, and they were, ended up being swept by the Sixers in the second round of the playoffs after winning a, you know, a three-game series in the first round. Yeah, after that, both guys were traded pretty quickly. McAdoo was traded midway through the following season for Tom Barker and three first-round picks to Boston. The interesting thing about that trade is McAdoo learned of it by reading newspaper, as did Red Auerbach and Dave Cowens, who was a player coach at the time, who had not been consulted by John Y. Brown and resented it very much. McAdoo felt unwelcome and found himself sitting. Cowens was playing center, and then he was traded almost immediately after the 79 season to the Pistons as compensation for ML Carr being signed as a free agent, and then things did not go well in Detroit, and then he kind of fell off from there. And then things definitely were even worse for Haywood, as bad as they were for McAdoo.
It was very... the Haywood thing was... A really bad situation. Now, I know, like, the Lakers were competing for a championship when he got traded from. He went to the Lakers.
Yeah, he went to New Orleans, I think, for a little while, and then he went to the Lakers.
Okay, and so they're in the finals, and then that whole, I know it came out recently, like he had talked about it a few years ago. But that he had become addicted to cocaine, and he was dismissed from the Lakers by Paul Westhead during the 1980 NBA Finals, which, you know, is like still to, I mean, like the way that he explained the story in Deadspin, which was like, which was like crazy, and just it was a lot.
Yes.
It tells you about that specific like era, especially with the role drugs played in the NBA and in basketball, and just how many players had issues with it during that time.
Yeah, and he basically plotted to murder Paul Westhead. I mean, he called an old gangster friend of his in Detroit and said, you know, and flew him out and said, you know, I want you to take care of this, and they plotted it all out, and obviously they didn't go through with it. And later, Haywood cleaned himself up, and, you know, and kind of became, you know, a role model for guys to, you know, in recovery and all that. But that's and Paul West said, you know, they've apparently, you know, they have no hard feelings now, and they, you know, they are fine now. But that's pretty amazing, to be honest. I mean, that's kind of a crazy situation. So
especially at the time, you know, with the final, like it's the finals. It's not just the especially at the regular season. So it's especially being in the finals is what makes it such a crazy story, and especially at that time, you know, it's just wow.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So the next trade of interest is one of the most famous, infamous trades in NBA history. Essentially, the Buffalo Braves and the Boston Celtics owner swapping franchises. This took place in June 1978, and it led to a trade between the two teams on August 4th, 1978. And it was Nate Archibald who was traded. He was traded by the who are now the Clippers from the Braves with Marvin Barnes, Billy Knight, a 81 second round draft pick that ended up being Danny Ainge, and then an 83 second round draft pick who was Rod Foster, to the Boston Celtics for Kevin Kunert, Kermit Washington, who had just signed with Boston and was expecting to stay there, Sidney Wicks, and Freeman Williams. And it was basically the situation was Irv Levin owned the Celtics but wanted to live in Southern California. He obviously knew that he could not move the Celtics, the you know the prize team of the NBA to Southern California. So he had convinced John Y. Brown, who had been the owner of the Kentucky Colonels. He was a owner of Kentucky Fried Chicken, probably more importantly than even the Colonels, but he had been an owner before. And Brown had actually taken like about a $3 million buyout from the Colonels when the merger happened, and then ended up buying the Braves for only like $500,000. So making a pretty good deal. Now, it wasn't quite as good as the deal that the St. Louis Spirits owners made to get the TV money for, you know, 35 years, but still a pretty good deal. And then the anyway, so now he's the owner of the Braves, and they basically made the trade so that John Y. Brown would get the Celtics, Irv Levin would get the Braves, and move the team to San Diego. So basically, the business entity that owned the Celtics became the business entity that owned the Clippers. And when like deferred compensation checks were mailed out to like, you know, guys like Tom Heinsohn, who was the, you know, former Celtics player and coach, they actually came from the Clippers bank account. Of course, the, you know, the team histories are, you know, weren't like that. The team histories, you know, went with the teams instead of, you know, staying with the entities that owned them. But I do find that kind of a fascinating situation.
Yeah, me too. I think it's I don't think you'll ever hear of this again. No. I think that's the biggest takeaway from reading about that is that this probably will never happen again. And it, at that time, I mean, that it sort of just shows you these owners are all over the place, and it just sort of was the wild, wild west type of approach in these teams making trades and trading franchises for each other. It sounds like something that could be in NBA 2K in a future time.
Exactly.
But yeah, it's crazy that happened. I can't imagine. And then, like, the whole Buffalo break that the Celtics were, like, a direct result of that former franchise. It's sort of crazy just to think that these owners really switched. And only really just because a person wants to move be in Hollywood and he's like, eh. But it also shows you, I don't think you can do that today, too, with a franchise. Not even because of the NBA rules specifically and how much you'd have to do to get around that. But just, I think teams have so much value that just moving them because, oh, on like, which, you know, him saying that he's a Hollywood guy, it's sort of like on a whim, like, oh, you know, I really feel like moving. That's why I feel like doing this. Now, I think it's just so hard to move a team. Just, you can't do it just because you feel like it. You do it because there has to be like legitimate reasons behind it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the obviously crazy stuff happens in the NBA and even on like the management level, but like the level of professionalism from the 70s to now is just completely totally different, you know. Just some of the stuff that you know, like I said, the 70s are just kind of like this wild wild west thing where, you know, anything goes, and all these franchises like are sort of like on the edge of, you know, they have a bad year and their existence is threatened, a lot of them. You know, there's a handful that are, you know, probably safe, but for the most part, you know, they're living on the edge almost all the time. So I guess it leads to sort of this desperate thinking. But one of my favorite anecdotes is well, there's two things I think that are interesting. One is that the owners did not consult anyone else. Red Auerbach did not know about the franchise swap, so he was as surprised as anybody. In fact, he signed Kevin Kooner and Kermit Washington to free agent contracts, expecting them to be part of the team, and then they were part of that franchise swap. And then another interesting one is that, of course, you know, eventually Irv Levin sells the team, the Clippers, to Don Sterling. And there's a story about Paul Westphal, who had, you know, signed a contract with the Celtics and then had some money deferred to him for the first 10 years after he retired, which was common back then, more known in the ABA, but apparently in the NBA as well. And then his accountant was going through the contracts and asked Westphal if he ever got the deferred money. He found out that they hadn't, so they approached Sterling about the money, which was something like $50,000 plus interest. And then Sterling told Westphal, "Oh, I've been meaning to pay you that. We didn't know where you were, and we couldn't find you." And then he laughed that Westphal, of course, had come to the Clippers arena at least twice a year when he was with the Suns. But, so virtually Sterling did pay it, but he never paid the interest on the debt. So there you go. Not the worst thing Don Sterling has ever done, but not ideal.
It's an example of why he built the reputation that he has today as an NBA owner.
Well, yeah, that and the racism.
Oh, yeah, that part too.
So the last trade that I want to talk about, and this is really the trade itself is not particularly interesting. It's from February 7, 1979. It's Harvey Catchings and Ralph Simpson traded by the 76ers to the Nets for Eric Money and Al Skinner. None of those players particularly noteworthy, but the interesting thing is on March 23rd, 1979, so about 6 weeks later, the teams actually had to replay their original game from November 8, 1978. And at this point, of course, those players play for the opposite teams. So they played for their original teams when the team began, and then they played for the teams they were traded to after the game resumed, which is the only time in the history of sports that any players played for both teams in the same game, apparently. So this is according to NBA.com. Yeah. So that's just a great story. I mean, that could really have happened at any time, I guess, but that's just, you know, that's a fabulous little quirky thing.
Yeah, that's a great one. I didn't even know that one either. That's crazy that they actually had to like start from that time of the trade. That's crazy though. I don't think we'll ever see, well, now, because they hold people out of games.
Oh, yeah, that would make sense. Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but that would obviously make more sense to do it than to replay it with opposite players. But yeah, apparently Eric Money was the only guy who scored for both teams. He ended it on, he was in the 76ers with Dr. J at the end. So are there any other trades that stand out to you? I'm going to address them with Rich and with you in a couple of the future episodes, including Earl Monroe and Jerry Lucas to the Knicks, Maravich to the Jazz, Kareem to the Lakers, Dr. J to the 76ers, Paul Westphal for Charlie Scott, Nate Thurman to the Bulls. So a lot of the other big trades like that, we do have plans to address elsewhere. Obviously, we go on forever, but we have to have limits on this show. But is there anything else that really stands out to you that you really want to bring up?
I mean, there are a few. I guess, like Moses Malone. I think you guys talked about it a little bit, like maybe when you guys covered Moses last summer after his passing. He was traded twice in like the span of like a month, from Buffalo to Portland to Houston. I thought that was really interesting, just especially because at that point in his career, you know, he had been in the ABA for a little bit, and then he was trying to find his way in the NBA, and so, you know, he gets traded, and then he couldn't agree on a contract with the Blazers, so they traded him like right away, and then he goes to Houston where he builds two out of his three MVPs, and he makes the All-Star team, I think, 5 out of the 6 years, and they make the finals 1 year when they lose to Boston. So I think that's like a really big deal that, you know, they couldn't work out a contract issue, and then he ends up being such a crucial part of the Rockets team before the Olajuwon Sampson era. Another one I thought was interesting was Adrian Dantley for Spencer Haywood, the New Orleans Jazz one that we talked about. How he ended up being a Laker was through a trade for Adrian Dantley, who with the Lakers, they already had Jamal Wilkes at forward, and I guess they felt like they needed more experience. And then Dantley went to Utah, and while they weren't a good team, really big numbers, that's where he sort of grew his legend as a great scorer, or as one of the great scorers of that like decade of the 1980s, eventually when he moved over to Utah. And so they never really had like a lot of team success. I think they made the semifinals a couple of times, and I don't think they won more than 45 games when he was there. But still, you know, like he built a really strong all-star career off of that. Another one I thought was interesting was the Bobby Jones, George McGinnis, Nuggets 76ers trade, because Bobby Jones played such a big role in the Sixers championship, and he was a key six man for them. And George McGinnis sort of like, he was a big, big time scorer and rebounder, but he never really, he struggled to gel with David Thompson in Denver. And they had sort of a rocky relationship on the court, not really off the court, but like on the court, they had a rocky, like they didn't fit well together, they didn't have good chemistry. So they're like, those are a few that I thought were interesting. And I think like one thing to note on is just how many trades feature or how many trades can be mixed up with like compensation, and how many draft picks end up going to places just because of a person signing somewhere and teams being compensated for it. So yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, compensation is kind of a weird that's a weird wrinkle that kind of add to all this, because yeah, that basically, for those who don't know, you know, free agency started right at you know, the end of the 70s, and they had you know, for the first few years, it was essentially, it was a compensation system where you could sign with a different team, but then the either the teams had to agree on some compensation, or the NBA commissioner would order, you know, compensation for the player. So I, you know, it really essentially was adding up to trades. And then after that, they got rid of compensation, but then they had a, you know, what was essentially restricted free agency up until 88, I think. Tom Chambers was the first unrestricted free agency. So yeah, I mean, free agency existed, but it was obviously in a much different form. Yeah, the McGinnis Thompson one, that's an interesting one. We'll have to delve into that later when we get into the we're going to talk a little bit about Thompson. But yeah, McGinnis also, at that point, you know, he was such a great player for the Pacers, but by that point, you know, he'd was already starting to decline, and there was a little bit of issues with you know, him and Irving kind of fitting together as well. And then, you know, not a huge surprise that would kind of be an issue with Thompson as well. But yeah, the only other trend that I would think is interesting, and Moses Malone is definitely a part of that, because of course he you mentioned the teams that he was on, but there's also a lot of other young players who bounce around quite a bit before, you know, before catching on with their team in the 80s. You know, you mentioned Dantley, Moses Malone, Maurice Lucas, you know, he went a few places. You know, was Portland and Kentucky Colonels and St. Louis Spirits, and Alex English, who went from Milwaukee to Indiana before settling into Denver. There were kind of a number of guys who, you know, started off their career with, you know, two or three different stops before they settled into a role and then ended up, you know, kind of sticking around in one place or you know, being a starter level player. So, you know, that certainly has happened since then. I mean, Chauncey Billups is obviously, you know, a pretty good example of that, but it's not like I can't think of a period in NBA history where that's like been, you know, a common trend.
Me too. I don't think that it's, especially with the high amount of players that it happened to, like you mentioning Alex English and Dantley are like two people that come to mind right away, and just sort of the early player movement, especially in their careers, because you don't really see it now, especially today with like teams owning like the players' rights, especially restricted free agency. Like it's only that a superstar like, you know, Kevin Durant and LeBron at those times when they're restricted at least keeps them with the team that drafted them for the first, you know, at least 7-8 years of their career. So it's so interesting to see these other guys like sort of just get moved so much, especially early on in their careers when they're like 24 or 25.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, and yeah, like it's, I think we've, you know, illustrated pretty well, it was a different time. So
most definitely.
Yes. So anything else before we head out?
Not really. It's really interesting to go through some of these trades and just to see what happens and what unfolded. And I'm really shocked some of the ones with the owners trading franchise for franchise, and players getting traded in the middle of games and having to replay them. It really shows you that there were a lot of really interesting NBA stories going on at that time, and just a lot of crazy situations unfolding.
Yes. So, and we've tried to share them with you throughout our Basketball Mysteries of the 70s series. Hopefully everyone is enjoying that. You can find us on Twitter and Facebook at Over and Back NBA. Let us know if you're enjoying what we're doing. Leave us a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you get your podcasts, if that's a option available to you. And until next time, thanks for checking us out. We're back again soon. Next time on Basketball Mysteries of the 1970s.
It's not that things didn't go well for the Sonics in 79-80. It was actually, you know, they won 56 games. It was the best point differential by far of any of the teams in this run. It was just that kind of the whole landscape of the league changed to some extent with the arrival of Magic.